Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening.
My guest today, Molly Knight, is the author of The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. Molly, welcome to View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, Molly, so if I gave you the choice of two guys, Madison Bumgarner or Clayton Kershaw, and you could A, start a horse farm, or B, build a major league franchise, which would you choose?
Well, that's pretty easy. I mean, I would use Bumgarner to help me build a horse farm, and I would use Kershaw to help me build a franchise.
Is it even close, though?
No, not close.
Okay, in either question, it's not close. So Bumgarner's your guy if you want to start a horse farm. Kershaw's clearly your guy if you want to start a Major League Baseball franchise, even though so far in their young careers, Bumgarner's had much more postseason success than Kershaw?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Kershaw was, he was actually, in 2013, he was actually quite dominant until that last game against the Cardinals when he was terrible. And then last year, he dominated that first game of the NLDS, and then it was the seventh inning where he came undone. But that day at Dodger Stadium, it was like, it was 100 degrees at first pitch, and I remember saying to someone, I don't think anyone's going to be able to go that long today because it was just miserable. And it's funny that Kershaw gets all this grief for coming undone in the seventh inning of that game, because Adam Wainwright was actually worse. He didn't make it. I think he was gone in the fourth or fifth, and he gave up. I forget what the score was at that point, but he was worse. You know, seven runs or six runs or whatever it was. I think it's just, you know, Kershaw is, in game four, he was brilliant until he hung that curveball to Matt Adams. So, I mean, yes, he's the last three games have not been ideal for him, but I just think, you know, the poor guy is sort of measured against himself because he's so good. We expect him to be perfect, and when he isn't, everyone freaks out, and he's the best pitcher in baseball, and I would ride or die with him no matter what.
Are Dodgers fans somewhat concerned about his, I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say, slow start? He's, what, did he win last night? Is he 4-3?
Yeah, well, he's great. I mean, I think so, but I think people are also, like, you know, looking at some of the advanced metrics. I mean, like last night with Andrew Kashner having this crazy line where he, you know, goes 4 2/3 innings or whatever it was and strikes out 12, walks nobody, but gives up 5 runs because he was just incredibly unlucky. And I think people are starting to look at stuff like that and realize that ERA does not tell the true story of what's going on. I mean, I think he still leads baseball in expected fielder independent pitching, which is a better marker than ERA. I'm looking, his ERA right now is 3.73, but his xFIP or xFIP is 2.18. So he'll be down to where he was, where he usually is. And his strikeouts are there, so I'm not worried at all.
And who would have thought that at this point in the season, where here we are in June, and who would have thought that Dodgers fans would be happier to have Andre Ethier in the outfield than they would Matt Kemp?
I know. It's a totally weird – baseball is just so weird. I was one of those people who predicted or thought that Matt Kemp was going to just go on a complete tear for the Padres. He looked phenomenal in the second half of last season. He was squaring the ball up and hitting it hard. He had developed some bad habits when he was injured in his batting stance, and he corrected those. And he seemed confident. He seemed happy. And honestly, then when I saw him on opening day, when he came to Dodger Stadium with the Padres, he actually seemed happier and more at ease than I had seen him in years. I think San Diego is a great environment for him. He's got a house near there. He doesn't have any of the baggage of the sort of, you know, drama surrounding him that's kind of surrounded him for his whole time in L.A., really. And I'm just pretty shocked. I don't know. To me, he doesn't look – he looks lost at the plate. He looks like he did the first half of last year. And he doesn't look to be in the best shape. I don't know what happened, but he doesn't look to be as lean and as strong as he was at the end of last season. So it's just a disappointment for the Padres at this point. But we'll see. He turned it around last year. He might do that again. We'll see.
Has Yasiel Puig proven himself to be expendable?
No. I mean, look, he – this is sort of like what I talk about in my book. He's got his issues. Everyone knows that. He can be, you know, exasperating to be around, like a 5-year-old. But he's still an amazing baseball player, and he's relatively cheap. So, you know, this idea that, oh, he's expendable. I mean, come on. You can never have too many great players. And he is the best offensive player on that team when he's going right. So, you know, if I'm the Dodgers, I do everything I possibly can to make it work with him, to get him healthy, to get him, you know, feeling okay, feeling good, and in that locker room and on the field, and keep him for as long as possible before I even think about trading him, regardless of his issues.
Heading into the season, what were the expectations, the Dodgers fans' expectations? Was it pennant bust? Was it World Series bust? Or are Dodgers fans different than the fans of other franchises in the sense that they're somewhat, I don't want to say complacent, because complacent's not a right word, but more happy to be really, really good, go to the playoffs, but that the ultimate goal, it's not as important as just having a capable team on the field?
Oh, no. I mean, Dodger fans won a World Series badly. They haven't won. Team hasn't won the World Series since 1988, which was the year that Kershaw was born. And I think
that's amazing.
Yeah, and I think that these last two years especially have just been so devastating. You know, losing to the Cardinals last year, they were winning or tied in every game in the playoffs until like the seventh inning when everything fell apart. And no, they won a World Series. I mean, the feeling is now like, the fans feel like, okay, we have the highest payroll and we have the smartest front office. Like, what's going on here? We need to win. I think because they have not, the Dodgers have not been to the World Series in 27 years now, that you know, winning the NL pennant this year would be great, a great step. I think that, you know, that would suffice. As much as people want to win a World Series, even getting there would be great this year. But no, they expect titles. This town has totally been spoiled by the Lakers and recently by the Kings. So no, they're not happy with just going to the playoffs. They want titles.
If you had to diagnose a weakness that could cost the Dodgers come October, what would you say that weakness is at this point of the season?
Well, right now, I mean, it's starting pitching. They've done the front office has done a great job building a competent roster, a functional roster, which is something that the team struggled with in the last few years. And they've got depth pretty much at every position. They have an embarrassment of riches, except for starting pitcher. They lost Hyunjin Ryu for the year, which is devastating. They lost Brandon McCarthy for the year, which is devastating. Right now, they've got Kershaw, Greinke, and Brett Anderson. And Brett Anderson is a tremendous pitcher, but he's always had a hard time staying healthy. So they've got to get more pitching. I expect them to try to either trade for Johnny Cueto or Cole Hamels, you know, before the break. And, you know, that's at this point, that's what's standing in the way. You know, talk about like Kershaw's, you know, part of his struggles in the playoffs had to deal with the fact that he had to pitch on 3 days rest because, they didn't have four competent starters. And with Rue last year, they had to roll the dice with him and he hadn't pitched in 6 weeks. So, you know, they've got to, or a month, I mean, they've got to get help there. Or else they're not gonna win the World Series if they don't get Cueto or Hamels or somebody of that ilk.
Well, you get a pitcher like Johnny Cueto or Cole Hamels, you're gonna have to give up something.
Right.
Phillies and Reds aren't just gonna take anything back. So
right.
who are you willing to part with if you're the Los Angeles Dodgers? Because they do have a bounty of talent on the farm, and some of the guys are close to coming up. You know, well, Jock Peterson's up, having a great year, and then there's a guy like, who is it, Corey Seager, who
right.
could fit in at shortstop at any time.
Right.
So would you be willing to give up a prospect like Seager to get
no.
Cole Hamels if you're
no.
the Dodgers?
No, they're not giving up Seager. Seager, they think of him as like, you know, the Derek Jeter type. I've heard Don Mattingly likes to say he reminds him of a cross between Derek Jeter and Buster Posey. I mean, they think this guy is going to be, you know, a franchise player for the next 20 years or 15 years or whatever it is. So they're not giving him up. I think they can get Hamels or Cueto without having to give him up, unless, you know, Amaro continues to be insane about what he's asking for. They've got great players in there. You know, Alex Verdugo is a player I've heard that a lot of teams covet. He's a fantastic hitter. You know, I could see them being more willing to part with Urias than Seager. Anytime you have a young arm like that, an 18-year-old, it's sort of terrifying and unpredictable what would happen. So they've got some ways to get, especially a Cueto, for guys like Verdugo or Grant Holmes and your Urias if they really are desperate.
It must be kind of surprising that the Giants are as good as they are this year. We were all told that heading into the season that they weren't going to be as good as they were last year when they kind of came out of nowhere and won the World Series. Are you surprised at all that the San Francisco Giants are having as good a season as they are so far this year?
I mean, I would say yes, but then I'm always surprised by them. I didn't think they were any good last year, and they weren't. They had Madison Bumgarner. They had the best playoff pitcher in the world, and he propelled them to the championship. And, you know, Giants fans get mad at me when I say that they aren't very good, but my point is, well, the 88 Dodgers weren't very good either. You know, they weren't. They were a team of scrappy players, and they had Earl Hershiser, who was very much, you know, like a Madison Bumgarner type, and then they had that crazy, you know, home run from Kirk Gibson. But they had no business being on the same field as the 88 A's with McGuire and Canseco and Eckersley and all, you know, all those players. So, but who cares? They won, and I don't think, you know, Dodger fans feel bad about it. If anything, they feel like it was a David versus Goliath. I mean, the Royals were a little different because it was David versus David. But, you know, not to take anything away from the Giants, they weren't that good, and they won. And so, you know, that makes it even more special, I think. I'm not surprised in a way, because they find a way. Like, I mean, if you look at their lineup, I mean, just geez, like Matt Duffy and Joe Panic and like whoever else they've got, and
yeah, Ryan, it's like who are these guys? It's like that classic line from the movie Major League. It's like who are these effing guys?
Right, and Ryan Vogelsong and the ghosts of Jake Peavy and Tim Lincecum and Justin Maxwell and Nori Aoki. I mean, geez.
And Bruce Bochy's enormous head. Who are these guys?
Right, but you know what? They have the best, in my opinion, they have the best, or if not the best, one of the best managers in baseball, in Bruce Bochy, and they've got one of the best game callers in baseball, in Buster Posey, and they know what it's like to be in the World Series, and they don't get nervous, and you know, God, more power to them. I think that what they've done is simply amazing.
You were tweeting a little while ago about how it's easier to watch Dodger games across the Pacific Ocean in Japan than it is in the TMZ.
Right.
What's it like? What's it like being a Dodger fan living in Los Angeles and not being able to watch the Dodgers on television?
It's incredibly frustrating. I mean, you know, I have like many people, I subscribe to MLB. At bat, so I can watch all the games and on MLB TV, but I'm blacked out. I can't watch them here. So when I go, I was in Japan 2 weeks ago, and you know, I loaded my at bat, and there I was. It said, you know, that I was in a location that I wasn't blacked out, and so it was great. I could watch. And then this last week, I was in the Virgin Islands and in St. John, and I was able to. It was the same thing. I was able to watch there as well. So it's frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating. I mean, I know a lot of fans have figured out a way to get around the blackouts, to, I guess, break the law or whatever it is. But it sucks that it has to come to that. You know, I didn't write about the blackout in my book because I thought that it was going to be resolved by the time my book came out, and then it would just be a moot point. But you know, now as it goes on, it's like, okay, well, I guess I'll have to if this is still like this in the year, I guess I'll have to write an addendum chapter for when the paperback version comes out, because it's ridiculous.
Well, who do Dodger fans blame? Do they blame ownership? Do they blame the cable companies? Where are the people on this issue?
I mean, I think they should be blaming ownership, because ultimately that's where the buck stops, you know, literally and figuratively. Ownership, you know, they're the ones that you know, own the rights to the Dodgers, to their games, and they could, you know, distribute themselves, or they could sell to a broadcaster like Time Warner. That's what they did. And so they can, you know, they can wash their hands of it and say, well, this is not our fault, it's Time Warner's fault. But, you know, I don't know that they actually sat down and said, oh, well, look, these mergers are on deck, and is that going to affect our product being on the air? You guys are giving us a lot of money. Is that going to affect the price that you ask from consumers? Is that going to affect, you know, our product getting on the air? I think that it was clear that they just wanted to get top dollar and sort of say, well, you know, and then wash their hands of it. So yeah, I blame them for most, actually, for all this.
And so if the ownership, the Dodgers ownership, is acting with hubris now, do they run the risk of alienating a portion of the fans so much that those fans will choose to follow other teams in the area, maybe the Angels, the Padres, or other teams up the coast? Is it that divisive of an issue?
I mean,
and certainly for young kids, right, who just want to watch their favorite team at home, and they can't right now. I mean, we're talking about formative years here, right? You run the risk of alienating some fans, I would think.
Sure. I mean, they have – so I think that they're going to get it resolved soon, in which case it's really only going to be a minor blip, and it won't affect anything long term. They have I think 30% of the households can get it right now, and it looks like pretty soon it'll be like 60% will be able to get it. I don't know, though. You know, I don't have any children, but if I had, you know, 7-year-old daughter who wanted to watch baseball, and that's when I started watching baseball, you know, she'd be watching the Angels right now because I get that channel, and she'd be becoming a fan of Mike Trout, I bet. So that would be, and I would have to, you know, support. I would support that, and I would be like, well, you know, that's too bad for the Dodgers. But if they get it resolved this summer, which I think they will, then they won't lose any fans. And honestly, their attitude is that this sucks and it's kind of a PR crisis, but their attendance has been up, and they haven't felt it in their wallets, obviously, because they're still getting the same amount of money. So they're sort of they don't think it's going to be a problem.
Which is too bad, though, because ultimately they do still run the risk of losing a lot of fans, especially young fans, like you were saying. Let's talk about some reporting you did a couple weeks ago for Sports on Earth. You went over to Japan and you wrote a very interesting article about what Major League Baseball can learn from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're concerned about a lot of the issues that baseball fans are concerned about, which is that, you know, baseball's audience has got to get younger.
Right.
And from reading your article, you do cover some things that Japan has figured out to make the game more appealing and energetic for a younger audience. Would you mind going over some of that stuff that you witnessed that maybe Major League Baseball could learn from?
Sure. I mean, the main thing was, like, it just seemed like their focus was on, you know, having as much fun as possible. I mean, they were still very competitive and it was very intense, but they seemed to understand that the Japanese people, something I love about the Japanese culture is this is a culture that works very hard. These people are very, very driven and very serious in their work, and they take great pride in it. But they also recognize that, like, they have to, you know, take a minute to unwind. You know, they sort of they party hard, and they know that baseball is a game, you know, and they go there and they just have a great time, and they don't take it so seriously. Like, you know, they don't police people who you know, flip their bats when they hit home runs. They don't, you know, they are there to have a good time, and that's very evident by the cheering sections. You know, they sit out in the outfield, and they have a section for visiting fans, and they cheer the entire game. It's very much like college football in that sense. And so it feels not only more fun in the sense of just cheering is fun, but you get a more like tribal aspect, you know, to sit with your, with other fans who work for the same team. And I don't know, it's fun. it's really fun. And I wish baseball, MLB would do that, you know, like block off some crappy seats for visiting fans. I feel
like I love that idea. I totally love that idea. And I wonder if the one thing that's holding Major League Baseball back from doing that, having opposing team cheering sections, is just how spread out the league is and how hard it would be maybe sometimes to draw enough fans to those games. Whereas in Japan, there's relatively closer proximity of these teams.
Sure. I mean, that's true. But again, we're talking about like cheap seats, you know, like,
yeah.
I just feel like, you know, most teams don't sell out anyway. We're not talking about reserving, you know, seats where you make a ton of money. And I don't know, like, I think it would be fun. You know, one of my friends, I went to Stanford and I'm a Stanford football fan. And one of my friends just this morning who lives in Denver sent me an email because he's trying to get me and a couple other friends to come out to Colorado for when Stanford goes there to play Colorado. And he sent me an email and it just talked about how, like, it was an email forward from Stanford saying, oh, here are our these are our section, you know, get your tickets now, you know, for our we arranged this, you know, special pricing located behind the Stanford bit, you know, and everybody gets to sit together. And that just, to me, like, that seems like, well, that would be fun, you know, like that's more, I feel like I'm more likely to travel to that game and go knowing that there's a section of Stanford fans than I would if I was just going to go, you know, get tickets on StubHub and sit with my two friends, you know.
I totally agree. And the other thing that I really stood out for me with your article from Sports on Earth was the whole really enforcing and really making sure that hitters stay in the batter's box. And Major League Baseball implemented all these speed up rules, but as you quoted Bryce Harper in your piece, you know, what is it to us at this point if we step out of the batter's box? You know, until they really incentivize it, people are going to still take their sweet ass time doing what they want to do in and around the batter's box. But in Japan, it's a little different.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't even know. So something I didn't write about in my piece because I'm not sure how I feel about it is they had a clock on the running clock basically on the scoreboard that just showed how long the game was going. So, you know, I'm looking up at this clock and it's like, oh, the game's been going for an hour and 1 minute. So the game's been going for an hour and 8 minutes. And, so it seemed like they were definitely very, very aware of that. And the game was flying by and I really it didn't seem like anything weird was being done. So I just, I was like, what's happening? And then I finally noticed, like, wait a minute. A guy fouled a ball off, and then he stepped out of the box. And the umpire, you know, took the, you know, threw a different ball back to the pitcher, and I was like, wait a minute. These guys aren't stepping out of the box ever. And I didn't even notice it. It was so not awkward that I didn't even notice it until, like, the sixth inning that none of them were stepping out of the box. And, you know, pitchers still took a second to compose themselves and look in for the sign. So it wasn't, like, rapid fire, you know. Like craziness, but it was great. You don't need these guys like doing what Nomar Garcia-Parra did between every pitch. Like, we don't need to, fans don't need to sit there for an extra 20 minutes because of someone's OCD, you know?
Like, yeah, I totally hear you. I went to a couple weeks ago, I went to a Mets game and Bartolo Colon was pitching and it was 2 hours, the game was a little over 2 hours long. And at the end of it, you know, I said to my friends, I said, that was one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had at the ballpark in recent memory.
Yeah.
It just makes such a huge difference. And I was actually there with young kids and, you know, the kids loved it and it was, you know, it was so much more enjoyable for everyone involved, all ages. It makes a huge difference. Major League Baseball still got to figure it out.
Right. I mean, look, we don't need to, and they're moving in the right direction. I think I saw, a pace of game. They released information about how long these games are taking.
Oh, is it better?
Yeah, it's better this year. And they're not enforcing the stay in the batter's box rule, but they're doing they cut the time, a little bit of commercial time off, and they're demanding that pitchers be ready like right when they come back, you know, and batters right when they come back. So I think the games are for the like first time in forever. Like the average pace of game is like under 3 hours now, and like that's great. All we need to do is, yeah, baseball is slow, but like all we need to do is cut off like 15, 20 minutes. You know, we don't need to cut it in half. That makes such a huge difference, I think.
Yeah. I still blame the pitchers. I mean, I know there are all these rules involved with hitters now as far as trying to stay in the batter's box, but I still blame the pitchers. The reason that game went quickly, the Mets game went quickly, was because both Bartolo Colon and I think it was Bud Norris pitching for the Orioles, they would get the ball back, and they were already on the rubber, and they were ready to throw their next pitch. And it just makes such a difference. And if they're ready, then the hitter is ready. And I think as much needs to be on the pitchers as it does the hitters.
Right. No, it's true. It's funny. In Japan, we were, like, noticing how fast the game was going. And then all of a sudden, like, they put it was the eighth inning, and the game started to seemed like it was starting to drag. And I realized, oh, my God, it's because they have a white pitcher on the mound, you know? I was like, no way. Like this is, I mean, it's funny that the programs were all in Japanese, so I didn't know, like, the names of the players, really, until after when I looked at the box score. But I forget who it was, but I was like, oh, my God, there's a white pitcher on the mound. Like,
oh, here we go. I've seen this game before.
Yeah. Oh, I just, yes, right now the average nine-inning game is 2 hours and 53 minutes. And last year it was 3 hours and 2 minutes. So we need to cut another 10 minutes off. Right now we've cut like 9 minutes off. We need another 10 minutes.
That's a lot better.
Yeah. If we can get these games out down to like 2 hours and 40 minutes, like that would be great.
That's what it was in the 80s. I remember hearing a stat in the preseason that said that the average length of a game in the 1980s was something like 2 hours, 20 minutes, 2 hours, 30 minutes. I mean, and what has changed since then? I don't think we're running more commercials.
You know, teams are doing just more in-game stuff, more music, more things that just take forever, you know, entertainment-wise. And actually, it's funny, the Dodgers are probably the biggest offenders with that. The new regime, their focus has been, and I talk about this a lot in the book, they want to be like the Lakers on grass, and like where it's, you come to the game, but it's not just a game, you're coming to like an entertainment thing. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff, audience interaction, on the scoreboard, the kiss cam, games where you're competing against a player to see how many baseballs you can pick up with chopsticks in a minute, or kids are racing to grab second base and race back to the bullpen, and stuff like that, that they want to really make it, you know, an entertainment event. So
you've mentioned your book several times now, The Best Team Money Can Buy, the Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse, comes out on July 14th. I know you can't say a lot about it at this point, but do you care to share anything about what you have there?
Sure. I mean, basically, this book is really just about the access that I got. These guys opened up their lives to me, and I was, you know, truly grateful and truly humbled to be there. So it's more about them than it is about me, and just, you know, it answers a lot of the questions about for fans, I think, about what these guys really go through, their personal struggles, you know, what it's like to be in a slump, you know, and go on Twitter and everyone's screaming at you, what it's like to be dealing with, you know, what the wives go through when they're sitting in the audience and their husband is pitching and giving up seven runs and, you know, they can't bear to watch and things like that. You know, what really went on, what really goes on during brawls and, you know, and how it is when you're playing with 25 guys and living in close proximity for 6 months of the year, and how, you know, 1 minute you can't stand the guy lockering next to you, and, you know, you're blaming him for the team's, you know, losing streak, and then the next minute he's your best friend again, you know. It's just crazy how a bunch of men in close proximity to each other for that long is pretty nuts.
You know what I've always wanted to know about the baseball brawl is why pitchers need to come in from the bullpens.
I know. They just have to feel like they're, you know, part of it, really.
It's part of their, like, exercise regimen, right? It's, like, part of their routine. They run in, and then they jog back. I feel it's almost like calisthenics. They serve no other purpose than just to get a little run in.
Oh, God. That's so funny you mentioned that, because the best was when Zach Greinke was involved in that brawl with Carlos Quentin, where Quentin broke his collarbone. Yeah. Well, the guys from the bullpen were sprinting in and, you know, to jump into the fracas, and Chris Capuano, when Greinke went down, he missed the better part of two, or he missed about 6 weeks. Chris Capuano was one of the guys who sprinted in from the bullpen. He had been put in the bullpen that year to start the year because he was like the sixth starter. And he, after Greinke went down, he took his spot in the rotation, but he only lasted like a couple innings in his first start, and it turned out he had a strained calf muscle that he had strained while he was running in from the bullpen to defend Greinke. So it was like that one pitch took out two of their starters.
I think my biggest concern if I were a player is that during a brawl, because coaches also wear uniforms, that if I was busy throwing haymakers, I might connect with a coach because you can't tell the difference.
No, you can't. And actually, J.P. Howell did that. He threw the Diamondbacks assistant hitting coach, Turner Ward, over the railing during a brawl, like WWF style. And Mark McGwire nearly killed Kirk Gibson, but that would not have been accidental.
There's probably a history there. Gosh, both those guys in their heyday, I'd pay to see that one too.
Oh yeah, no, they didn't think much of Kirk Gibson, so that was awkward.
What about Twitter though? Quickly, I know you got to go here in a second, but Twitter, you said that you're kind of getting an all access pass to these guys and their lives away from the field in your book. Do these guys really care all that much about what people say about them on Twitter? Do they check? I mean, I know there are guys involved in social media, but do they really check their mentions? Do they really care?
They do. They do. I mean,
they should know. They should know better.
But they're humans. I mean, they're not. Yeah. They see. They read everything. Well, actually, it's so funny. What's really interesting to me is, beat writers will tweet snarky shit about players. They'll be like, oh, you know, so-and-so sucks or whatever. And I don't think that they understand that the players see everything. So then they walk into the locker room, like trying to, interview that guy or if they're a blogger, they call the team or whatever and try to get the guy on the phone. And it's like, do you not real understand that person saw your tweet calling this guy like the worst player ever? You know, like it's amazing to me. Just because a guy doesn't have a Twitter, you know, you have to assume that whatever you put out there, everyone and anyone is going to see.
Right.
You just have to assume it. So yeah, they see it. I mean, some of them are more obsessive than others. They're humans. So they of course they're going to focus on the negative stuff. Or their friend is going to tell them, you know, hey, did you see like so-and-so's on this, you know, talking shit about you, you know, like you blah, blah, blah. They're going to see it. So
yeah, I just love the thought of Clayton Kershaw sitting in his locker, icing his left shoulder and scrolling through his mentions like, you know, you or I would after writing a column. Oh, let's see what the feedback is. You know, Clayton Kershaw's sitting there going, yeah, maybe I do need to really work on finishing that off-speed pitch a little bit more.
Well, Kershaw's a little different. I mean, he's sort of he's a very different animal. I don't think he spends much time on social media at all.
Good.
But, yeah, but
– yay to him.
But most of them do. I mean, he's sort of, I talk with him about this and he talks about this in my book a lot. He's actually, not that social of a person. He's not the kind of like guy who goes to a party and like walks up to people that he doesn't know and like hangs out. So I just think he's very focused. He's somebody who his ability to focus is unlike anything I've ever seen among athletes. So I don't think he lets that stuff get in his way at all, actually.
That's probably one of the reasons that makes him such a good pitcher.
It is. I absolutely what makes him the best in the world at what he does. He doesn't he's so focused, he doesn't let any of this crap get in his way.
Probably another thing that would make him a very good horse farmer. In fact, maybe as good a horse farmer as Madison Bumgarner.
That's funny that you asked that because I think Madison Bumgarner wanted to name his horse after Kershaw, or he was looking for a horse and he wanted a Clayton Kershaw type horse or something.
I knew there was something. One of those guys mentioned horses at some point, which is why I asked the question originally. I think it was Bumgarner who. You're right, who named a horse Kershaw or wanted to name a horse.
Right.
Horses are involved somewhere in this Madison Bumgarner story, right?
I mean,
I'm not just making this up.
And, like, I love Bumgarner. I mean, I am a huge, huge fan of Bumgarner. So You know, it's probably a tougher call than I said originally, picking between the two of them, just because, you know, I adore Bumgarner. I think he's phenomenal. He's a phenomenal pitcher. He seems like a really interesting dude.
Totally.
And just a total gamer. So I'm a huge fan of his.
I read somewhere after he won the World Series that it was talking about how many Bumgarners there are in his hometown.
Oh, right.
And that I believe at one point in high school he actually dated a girl named Madison Bumgarner.
Yeah, which is like – and they say they're not related, which is like a bit puzzling to me. Yeah. No, he's just – he's a character. I mean, I would have loved it if he were a Dodger and I could have written about him, because my book is – it's a baseball book, but it's really – mostly about people and characters.
Yeah.
And yep. that would have been an absolute joy. That New York Times piece, I forget who wrote it, but after the World Series, there was a piece about his father. Somebody went down and met his father, and it was phenomenal. So he's like a folk hero in my mind, and I love the snot rockets he blows on the mound. I mean, I can't help but be a fan of him and of Tim Lincecum, really. So I don't get that. I mean, obviously, I want the Dodgers to win the World Series because that will help my book sales. But
yeah.
But you know, I can't really complain about Madison Bumgarner being out there on the mound in October, because he's just a joy to watch.
Yeah, the one final story about Bumgarner, I was watching the Brewers Cardinals game, and they were talking about the ESPN announcers were talking about Carlos Gomez and how Carlos Gomez is prone to getting with scuffles with other players, and they referenced the incident with Madison Bumgarner, I think from earlier in the year, where I don't know if Bumgarner came inside and Carlos Gomez looks out at him and basically says, "Who are you?"
Right.
And Madison Bumgarner's like, "I'm Madison Bumgarner."
Right. Well, I mean, and I do think that Bumgarner needs to watch it a little bit, because I don't appreciate, if he's going to become the sheriff of MLB, like Ryan McCann, then he's going to be off my list, because I don't like that. That goes back to what I was saying about, you know, we got to like let these guys have some fun. We got to let them, you know, shit talk a little bit and be themselves. And, you know, Carlos Gomez, obviously he plays with a lot of emotion, and he was yelling at himself after he fouled a pitch off, and it was a fat pitch, and he knew it was going to be the only fat pitch he saw, and he was yelling at himself, and Bumgarner was like, "What?" You know, and Gomez is like, "Dude, back off. I'm yelling at myself." So Bum has to watch it a little bit. I still love him. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt for a while, but he has to tone down the sheriffing to really remain near the top of my list.
That's like why Puig caught a lot of crap when he first came into the league, right? Because he played a different style of baseball than a lot of fans in this country were used to. But that style ends up being quite refreshing. And there's a reason why Puig, you know, really resonates with younger fans, is because he's both an exciting player and he's an exciting person who plays with passion, a kind of passion that, as you said, the sheriffs of Major League Baseball are those guys who like to think of themselves as the sheriffs don't stand for. But at the same time, it's really good for the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. Puig, I don't think when he bat flips, I just think it's second nature. I don't even think he knows he's doing it. You know, he's not doing it to rub it into anybody's face. He just is so excited.
Is that the same thing as when he overthrows a cut?
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, and with Puig, I think for him, it's a balance. Like, I don't want him to cut that stuff out. I want him to keep bat flipping and trying to throw people out and all that. But he's also got to figure out a way to, like, not piss off his teammates so much and piss off other players to the point where his antics cause Bumgarner or Wainwright or whoever else to throw at the back of another player, of a teammate, because that's just not going to – that doesn't win him fans in his own locker room. But, yeah, no, they've got – Puig's exuberance and excitement is what makes him great. So that challenge is to sort of, you know, get him to mature without watering him down, which is going to be difficult, but we'll see. Dodgers have a phenomenal coaching staff, honestly. Mattingly and Tim Wallach and Mark McGwire are just phenomenal men. So I'm optimistic that they'll be able to. If Puig is willing, I'm optimistic that this is the right group to mold him.
Well, Molly Knight, author of The Best Team Money Can Buy, Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse, out July 14th. Thank you so much for talking baseball with me today.
Yeah, thanks, John. Anytime. It was fun.